Looking up at the stars, I know quite well that for all they care, I can go to hell. But on Earth, indifference is the least we have to dread from man or beast. How should we like it were stars to burn with a passion for us we could not return? If equal affection cannot be, let the more loving one be me. Admirer as I think I am of stars that do not give a damn, I cannot, now I see them, say I missed one terribly all day. Were all stars to disappear or die, I should learn to look at an empty sky and feel its total dark sublime, though this might take me a little time. The more loving one. Welcome or welcome back to Professing Literature, wherever you're listening to us from, and whenever you're listening to us. We're in Oklahoma City as the summer is turning into autumn in the year of grace 2023. Professing Literature is, of course, the podcast where we look closely at short passages of important works of literature in the hopes of seeing writers in action. We aim to work across literary genres and modes, comedy and tragedy, drama, pick poetry and fiction, looking at the dynamics of a passage in order to understand what the author is doing and what is at stake for the work as a whole, the issues that are clarified, the techniques that are involved. I am David Anderson. I'm a professor of Renaissance Literature at the University of Oklahoma, and I am joined by Mr. Eric Williams. Good day, Eric.
Good day to you, David.
Well, it's good to be with you again. How are things in the Williams world?
They're good. And you should probably tell everybody where we are broadcasting, or podcasting, I guess is more correct. Where are we?
Yeah.
It's a big deal.
Well, yeah, we're actually in what is in process of becoming our podcast studio, which is in the lovely Williams home, which listeners of our last episode will recall, the Williams family had just moved. And so now they've got a space that not only benefits them, but benefits this podcast. So that's pretty great. And so Eric knows what he's doing where these kinds of things are concerned. And so he's in midstream with turning this very nice room into the perfect podcasting zone. So we're very pleased about that. It's going to make life more convenient for both of us because, you know, we had to, up until now, record at bus shelters and under overpasses and things like that, wherever we could get an electrical outlet.
Yes,
and so we bumped around. We recorded one at my house.
Oh, yeah.
Just at the kitchen table. I think that was Beowulf. And that was pretty echoey, and I think it was in the middle of summer, and I think we heard my air conditioner coming on about, it seemed like four times a minute, that it would come on and make noise. And so that was less than ideal already because it was a kitchen table in the home of a pretty large family. And so there are only so many times in the year where that would be available noise-free.
Right.
So this is going to suit us a lot better. And, you know, we'll have to clear a big space on the wall for all the podcasting awards that
we're sure
to win.
Yeah.
You know, at some point when we really achieve exit velocity and this thing takes off the way I know that you, our loyal listenership, fully expect it to. And then you'll just have to put up with me doing those annoying live reads of like Mercedes-Benz commercials and things like that, because you've heard me on this subject before, but when the sponsors are clamoring at our door, we're not above taking their money and hopefully not testing your patience too much. Like we're not cheap. We're not going to take just anything, and we're going to have to make sure Eric and I, you know, as the proposals come in, we'll talk them over carefully and make sure does the corporate culture of, say, J.P. Morgan Chase or Kraft Foods really fit
right.
our ethos?
Right.
You know, is this who we want to be associated with? It's not just going to be a free-for-all. And, you know, money will talk, but it will only talk so much because...
It's got to make sense, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Because some of the suggested ones that have come up have been pretty, like a, I don't know, I'm not bashing, like, life coach strategy. Listen to this life. It's like, yeah it's got to fit in some way, or at least parallel.
I'd have to feel awfully confident in someone before I signed off on them as a life coach, because you, our listeners, matter too much to us for that. And yeah, I think Eric and I both listen to enough podcasts to know the flavor of these things. And I'm not judging any other podcaster, Eric, but I'll hear sometimes there's a certain very successful startup company that makes men's and possibly women's underwear, and that's fine. And they get all kinds of endorsements on all kinds of podcasts. And you hear these hosts talking about how they wear the product and can't imagine wearing anything else. And, you know, I'm sorry, that's too personal. And it might be fine for them, but we know where our lines are and the kinds of things that we're willing to endorse. So, you know, there are some very venerable companies, you know, Sotheby's Auction House or something like that. But we will kick the tires hard and make sure it's a proper fit and that we can look our children in the eye and say, yes, that that new car in the driveway that was purchased with the proceeds, this big deal we struck is something you can feel good about, son.
We'll be able to say that in about 30 years, maybe.
Yeah, you know, like rate. It's a slow burn.
Yeah.
Some of the best things in life are that way. It's just, it's going to be overseen with by men of conscience. You can trust to that.
Absolutely.
So.
Well.
And I'm sure today's subject, if he were hearing this, would be rolling his eyes at this attempt at humorous moral bloviation, because he was better than this kind of thing. So... With that smooth, seamless segue.
Can I real quick?
Yeah.
Just one thing on the studio. So we've got to come up with a name for it. Be thinking about that.
Yeah.
If anybody has any thoughts out there listening, what should we name the studio? I mean.
Yeah. Any tips for the way in which we should set it up? Like, people have been saying, well, what about marble floors and marble columns? But it's just that's too much echo. That's not gonna work.
Yeah. I'm not gonna do that.
And you know, a great big fountain would look wonderful, but that tinkling noise in the background
would mess with
our audio.
We'd have to be able to mute it.
Yeah. And so, if you're muting the fountain, then what's the point of
it?
Yeah. Those tens of thousands of dollars could probably be better spent on something else.
Well, how about a chocolate fountain?
So that's a little bit less...
Because that wouldn't really make a lot of... I mean, there would be a noise of it turning, but maybe it would be low enough.
Sickly gurgle.
And that way we could, you know, cover chocolate on strawberries or whatever, you know.
Sure, yeah.
Or cookies, you know.
Yeah, dip them in. You might have trouble keeping your children out of here, although I guess they'd just get used to it. It'd be no big deal to have a chocolate fountain. I think of those things. I don't think I've ever been in the actual presence of a chocolate fountain, but I think of them as being a sort of occasional thing for a party. Does someone just have them going like 24 hours a day?
There's a first time for everything, right?
Yeah, sure. That chocolate would get pretty funky, I think, after a while. So that would mean sort of, I don't know, if every half day or something, you have to replace it and clean up the pipework. It might be more trouble than it's worth, but until you, as you say, until you poke around and figure it out, you just don't know.
Yeah.
But we'll give deep thought to this, you know, a series of marble busts of like Shakespeare and Cervantes and, you know, Balzac and all these people, something like that. It's all on the table.
Yeah. Well, hopefully next, on the next episode, we'll have a a name that you can add into your intro. Coming to you live from
Podcast Xanadu.
Yeah, you know, something like that. It'll make us sound way more important than we really are.
Yeah. Well, we wouldn't want that.
No.
All right. Well, now is the perfect time to bring up the name of Hugh Whiston Auden, W.H. Auden, who is our subject for today, and someone I love teaching and talking about. And there were so many different poems I could have taken to introduce you all to Auden, if in fact you don't know of him. And I hope I know I made a good choice. Who knows if it was the best choice, but Auden is unquestionably one of the great English poets of the 20th century. His lifespan runs 1907 to 1973. So he was born into a world where electric lighting still hadn't replaced gas lighting in much of England. He was born in York in northern England, and yet he died having written a poem about the moon landing in 1973, was the year of his death. So he's born in England. He's the son of a doctor, I believe, and a nurse. So he comes from, I guess, an upper-middle-class family, well-educated, finishing his education at the mighty Christ Church College at Oxford University. And even then, he was recognized as one of the great literary talents of his generation, which, of course, was, at that point, we're in the 1920s, and the generation is that of the modernists, of the high modernists. Throughout his career, Auden proved himself to be a brilliant experimenter in poetic structure. He would write in any poetic form, running from medieval forms all the way through modernist free verse and back and around again. He was an inspired essayist and literary critic, and he was even a writer of things like opera libretti. In the 1920s and 30s, when he was still a young man and much of his most famous poetry was being written, although there's great poetry throughout his career, he was very much on the cutting edge of social and political issues. He was one of those who went to Spain in his idealism, hoping to help the Republican cause, got somewhat disillusioned. And then at around the time when World War II was breaking out, he made the decision which shocked and upset many of his countrymen of emigrating to the United States. This was not a decision he took lightly. He loved England and his Englishness. He felt he had to leave. And of course, this was at the time of England's greatest peril. It's not as though His Majesty's Armed Forces missed out on much. It's hard to imagine Auden making a kind of soldier or sailor or airman. But it was a difficult decision that many people questioned when he moved across the ocean. And eventually, in the mid-1940s, he took out U.S. citizenship. He was a man of great feeling and sensitivity and personal generosity. He was a man of lifelong contradictions. He was a gay man, an openly gay man, who had a profound conversion to Anglican Christianity, much like T.S. Eliot was undergoing at approximately the same time. And the different sides of himself were never fully reconciled. This poem that we're looking at today is interesting. It's interesting for its own sake, but in terms of where it lies in Auden's life, it's on the cusp of his religious conversion before it fully happens. And it's also written just, as you'll see, just after his emigration to America. And of course, the title of the poem, September 1st, 1939, refers to the outbreak of hostilities in the Second World War. The 1st of September was the date of Hitler's invasion of Poland. Of course, it was a joint invasion with the Soviet Union coming in from the other side. And 2 days later, on the 3rd of September, Britain and France would fulfill their treaty obligations and declare war on Germany. So this is the outbreak of the Second World War. And Auden is processing what it means and how to understand it. The poem is made up of regular stanzas, 9 stanzas, each of 10 lines. The poem has a sort of intermittent rhyme scheme, and it's full of mostly half rhymes, partial rhymes, where the rhyme isn't really clean and ringing, but is kind of soft and muted. So I'll begin, as is my practice, by reading the poem, and then we'll talk about it. September 1st, 1939, by W.H. Auden. I sit in one of the dives on 52nd Street, uncertain and afraid, as the clever hopes expire of a low, dishonest decade. Waves of anger and fear circulate over the bright and darkened lands of the earth, obsessing our private lives. The unmentionable odor of death offends the September night. Accurate scholarship can unearth the whole offense from Luther until now that has driven a culture mad. Find what occurred at Linz, what huge imago made a psychopathic god. I and the public know what all school children learn. Those to whom evil is done do evil in return. Exiled Thucydides knew all that a speech can say about democracy and what dictators do. The elderly rubbish they talk to an apathetic grave, analyzed all in his book, the enlightenment driven away, the habit-forming pain, mismanagement, and grief. We must suffer them all again. Into this neutral air, where blind skyscrapers use their full height to proclaim the strength of collective man, each language pours its vain competitive excuse. But who can live for long in an euphoric dream? Out of the mirror they stare, imperialism's face and the international wrong. Faces along the bar cling to their average day. The lights must never go out. The music must always play. All the conventions conspire to make this fort assume the furniture of home, lest we should see where we are, lost in a haunted wood. Children afraid of the night, who have never been happy or good. The windiest militant trash important persons shout is not so crude as our wish. What mad Nijinsky wrote about Diaghilev is true of the normal heart, for the error bred in the bone of each woman and each man craves what it cannot have, not universal love, but to be loved alone. From the conservative dark into the ethical life, the dense commuters come, repeating their morning vow, I will be true to the wife, I'll concentrate more on my work, and helpless governors wake to resume their compulsory game. Who can release them now? Who can reach the deaf? Who can speak for the dumb? All I have is a voice to undo the folded lie, the romantic lie in the brain of the sensual man in the street, and the lie of authority whose buildings grope the sky. There is no such thing as the state, and no one exists alone. Hunger allows no choice to the citizen or the police. We must love one another or die. Defenseless under the night, our world in stupor lies, yet dotted everywhere, ironic points of light flash out wherever the just exchange their messages. May I, composed like them, of eros and of dust, beleaguered by the same negation and despair, show an affirming flame. So that's September 1st, 1939. We have here what I think has to be among the best-loved poems of the 20th century, but it was not loved by the author. It's one of the interesting facts about this poem, which is one of Auden's most famous, that he came quite soon after it was published. It was published in October of that year, I believe, in the New Republic. So it was published within weeks of its being written. He came to despise it, and he even withheld it from some future collections of his work. In some cases, he amended a line, changed it. I'll talk about that further on. And I think in one or two cases, he cut out a couple of stanzas. So clearly feeling like there was something of value in the poem, but that it didn't work. Why did Auden do that? He said in, I think in an annotation in one of his collections, that he considered it trash and was ashamed to have written it, which is a striking thing to say. Not very many poets say that about a published poem, at least not so loudly, and especially of a poem that's so celebrated. The reason seems to be, and I can't speak for Auden, I can only infer a couple of things from a little bit of reading. It seems like he felt the ending of the poem didn't work, that it was perhaps a little callow, a little naive, and worst of all, in his opinion, a little self-congratulatory, giving the sense that he and the readers of his poem and other like-minded types are the good people who understand these things. You know, we are, to use one of his words, the just. Now, I think he was being too hard on himself. First of all, it's worth saying that a poem is a poem is a poem is a poem. And even if the poet wants to recall it or wants to interpret it for you, they can't. It exists in and of itself. And you don't have to be too radical in your view of the author-poet-poem relationship, I think, to think that, you know, we can work with what is on the page. And going further, I think Auden was overdoing the criticism. He was a man of sensitive conscience, and he was a man who was coming more and more to, and the poem gives a real sense of this, he was coming to doubt his own moral rectitude and to be suspicious of the idea that he could call himself one of the just. But I think the actual weight of the poem goes to that very point. And so with respect to Auden, I'm going to plunge on and talk about this one. And so as much as I admire Auden's modesty, which I think is what motivated his dislike of his poem, I'm not ready to abandon it. There's a sense, first of all, of the mood that it captures on that extraordinary day of confusion and fear and anger. The idea that political history is not alone sufficient to explain what's going on, and that a deep moral probing is called for, which emphasizes not only other people's moral failings, but our own. These are themes that I think are very worthy, and that I think he does justice to. So, begin at the beginning. I sit in one of the dives on 52nd Street, uncertain and afraid. There are so many famous lines in this poem. And this is a very famous opening. Note how Auden begins with this very concrete situation and location that we can picture. It's suggested generally, I think, by those who knew New York. First of all, his English readership are going to know he's talking about New York because New York had those famous numbered streets. There's no 52nd Street anywhere in the United Kingdom, I'm quite sure. There are a bunch of them in America, including my hometown and Eric's hometown of Oklahoma City, where more streets are numbered than they are named. But we know, as soon as we read that, that we're talking about New York. And he's in one of the dives on 52nd Street. Now, those who know would say this probably means what would nowadays be called a gay bar. I'm not entirely certain about that, but it seems quite likely. But he gives himself, of course, he describes himself not as reveling or as enjoying himself, but sitting uncertain and afraid in this particular place. And so for the poet, we already have this sense of the ocean between him and his home, that he's far away from it, but that he's still caught up in it. America, of course, will not be dragged into the war until more than 2 years from this point, but it's under the same shadow that's hanging over the democracies in Europe. And so we have this personal emphasis at the beginning and this sense of the speaker's emotional turmoil in this very particular place, he says, as the clever hopes expire of a low, dishonest decade. It's a wonderful phrase, an oft-quoted phrase to describe the 1930s, although I don't know many decades in the last couple of hundred years to which it couldn't be attached the low dishonest decade, the decade of negotiation among the great powers, the decade wherein people had fatuous hopes, I suppose, that totalitarianism could be handled and managed, the hopes of the Munich crisis in 1938 that eventually came to nothing because war was coming. And so we have that famous description of the previous 10 years, beginning the poem with this sense of the past. There is strong sense of past and present in this poem, and this doubtful sense of future. But Auden talks a lot about the past in this poem, especially in the opening stanzas. And then he doesn't so much look ahead as he looks within. He tells us that waves of anger and fear circulate over the bright and darkened lands of the earth, almost as though he can feel them, these waves that ripple through whole peoples. And he has the description of the bright and darkened lands of the earth. We don't know what that means. It might be that the bright lands of the earth are the democratic lands, and the darkened lands are those that are given up to tyranny of one kind or another, and that would be fair enough. He may be speaking in a more traditional sense of the so-called developed and undeveloped worlds. We don't know, but we have the point made that however you read that phrase, this anger and fear is going through all of them. Something terribly universal is happening. And he says they are obsessing our private lives. And so we have this feeling in moments of great national trauma or worry that the outer world is breaking in on us, that we are not being allowed to kind of maintain that private space within ourselves where we can say, I may watch the news at night and I'll vote when there's an election and that I'll have my political opinions, but my life does not belong to those politics. And sometimes there come points where we struggle to maintain that distinction, because the idea that bombs might start falling in the place where I live, or in the case of Auden, where in the places where his loved ones live, or that I or someone I love might be called up and conscripted and put into a uniform, means that border between public and private becomes untenable. And he concludes the stanza by saying, the unmentionable odor of death offends the September night. September nights, of course, being especially beautiful as summer gently gives way, but hasn't quite given way yet. But now there's this stink, this odor of death, and smell is a great metaphor for what he's talking about, something everybody notices, what he calls the odor of death, but doesn't want to mention, the unmentionable odor of death that's too awful to talk about, perhaps too squalid and shameful to talk about. And so this is the opening move of situating that he gives at the beginning of the poem to sort of anchor us in a point and in a certain emotional landscape. And so it's almost like he needs to pin that down and make it clear so that then he can go on to investigate the deeper things that are stirring, that perhaps explain those waves of anger and fear and what's going on in the world. In the second stanza, you know, we begin with this highly personal and quite concrete situation in the first stanza. In the second stanza, he backs up and clears his throat. And all of a sudden sounds, at least at the beginning of the stanza, detached, saying in a detached way, accurate scholarship can unearth the whole offense from Luther until now that has driven a culture mad. So, of course, he's talking about Germany and German history and the previous 500 years of German history, where it seemed like the German peoples in the Holy Roman Empire and then later were trying to make sense of themselves and their nation, but were eventually, as he suggests, driving themselves mad to the point where the culture of Luther and the culture of Beethoven and Goethe has now become the vehicle for this terrible thing, this war that is coming. He says we could find out what occurred at Linz. Linz is a town in Austria, and it's famous, unfortunately, for Linz, for being a place where Hitler spent some of his boyhood. So we have Hitler referenced but unmentioned by name. He says, to find out what occurred at Linz, what huge imago made a psychopathic god, because that is what Hitler seems to have become. Linz brings us into that shadowy part of Hitler's very shadowy biography, those formative years that would unquestionably have proved crucial to making him the man that he became. We know about him being stuck at a school he hated. We know about him clashing over and over with a dominating, abusive father. Something happened there. And of course, the phrase imago is key to that, because when you hear the phrase imago, you're in the realm of psychologist, psychoanalyst talk. The imago can suggest the child's overblown conception of a parent. I don't know anything about Alois Hitler, Adolf's father, other than a few general facts, but we know that whatever went on in that house was dark, even if an observer could never have guessed what would eventually happen. But what eventually happened was the creation of what Auden calls a psychopathic god. And so in this stanza, he's suggesting that the scholars or academics or historians or political theorists' detached view, the accurate scholarship, can perhaps get us a certain way towards understanding. The biographer's toolkit can perhaps explain to a certain extent why reality has taken the shape in this September moment that it has taken, but that it's not a problem that those things can fully, or maybe even mostly, understand. Something more is needed than that accurate scholarship. And Auden suggests that that accurate scholarship, really, whatever it churns up, won't tell us anything we don't already know. And we have these vivid and terrible lines at the end of the stanza. I and the public know what all school children learn. Those to whom evil is done do evil in return. That is not to say, I think, that the Second World War can be explained by the fact that Hitler had an abusive father. That's maybe a necessary but not a sufficient explanation for what that man became and what he was able to do. But it is suggesting, first of all, that there are commonplaces that are as clear as crystal to anyone who has opened their eyes in this world, and also makes the important point, in a world where accurate scholarship in the 1930s and beyond is often very much possessed by the idea of sort of impersonal material and economic and political forces directing events, Auden is stressing that the human heart has certain immutable laws. And one of those laws is that cruelty begets cruelty. And so he's seeing Hitler here to a certain extent as that child who is carrying anger and wounds that are both perfectly obvious to anyone with a brain and a pair of eyes, but also nothing new in the human condition, and that also are something that all of us can understand. And so he's beginning to introduce the idea, not that everyone is equally culpable in what Germany is doing, but that all of us are part of the same species and have a certain, even if it's unarticulable for most of us, have a certain internal correspondence with the idea that human pain begets human pain. He takes us back then, speaking of accurate scholarship, he takes us back to Thucydides and the Peloponnesian War at the end of the 5th century, the end of the great Athenian Golden Age, when Athens, for reasons that are both comprehensible and incomprehensible, went to war with a consortium of other Greek states led by Thebes and Sparta and ruined itself. Thucydides is the great historian of that war, of the Peloponnesian War. He was an Athenian statesman and general himself, not a very successful one. And he literally wrote the history of at least most of that conflict. And Thucydides, he says, understands democracy and he understands dictators. Thucydides gives us the speeches. He gives us the great funeral oration of Pericles. He understands the democratic impulse that was so central to Athens as it is to America. He also understands the dictator and the kind of things dictators do, the elderly rubbish they talk, giving us the idea that every dictator who seems to situate himself as the solution to all of our problems and promise the remediation of those problems is simply reading from an old speech that was written thousands of years ago. And so Thucydides understands these things, Auden says. He was here before us, but by implication, we don't listen to him. We don't learn our lessons. And he then goes on to suggest what it will cost to have not learned those lessons, the Enlightenment driven away. The Enlightenment driven away in the 20th century by Stalingrad and Hiroshima and Midway and El Alamein and all these other terrible battles, which, whether the good guys won or lost, produce world-changing carnage and give us the feeling of a civilization struggling to hold on to what little it can hold on to of its own best self. That is certainly the story of Thucydides' Athens, where this great golden age of the tragedians seems to be swallowed up and lost by the Peloponnesian War. And Athens, of course, emerges from that war, having lost it, and it's still Athens, but that Enlightenment has been checked and upended. And he says, mismanagement and grief, Auden says, mismanagement and grief, we must suffer them all again. And for someone reading these words in 1939, a chill is going to be struck over them at that moment, because Auden was of a generation that had been born just a little bit too late to take part in the carnage of the Somme and Passchendaele in the First World War. But everyone of his generation and the generation before it knew what the world had gone through in those 4 years, from 1914 to 1918, and what they had cost in terms of blood and treasure and national vitality. And of course, the desire to avoid another world war was one of the key motivators of those who had tried to appease Hitler unsuccessfully. And the idea that once again we're going to return to the mud of Flanders, to poison gas, and to far worse weapons than they had had a generation earlier, would have been chilling and terrifying. Here we go again. He reminds himself that he's not in the Flanders mud right now. He's not even in London. He's in what he calls in the next stanza the neutral air, this neutral air. So we're back in New York City, in Manhattan, into this neutral air among what he calls the blind skyscrapers. Skyscrapers, of course, are one of the emblems of New York. Skyscrapers are all over the world now. But for someone from the old world in the 1930s, they were definitive of New York in a way that's probably hard to appreciate today, because now all of the European capitals have their skyscrapers. But in those days, these enormous, tall buildings were really symbolic of New York City. And so he is among the blind skyscrapers, these towering things that rear up and have to be seen, but which cannot see themselves, he says. They're blind skyscrapers. And he says, they use their full height to proclaim the strength of collective man. So these skyscrapers, which define New York, are making a statement about what human beings can do. And of course, they do make that statement. Architecture like that, to go to New York even today, when you're not used to it, as I'm not especially used to it, is to experience those skyscrapers and to be sort of moved and struck by what human beings can do. And so they proclaim the strength of collective man, and collective man is very strong. This American spirit that he seems to read in those skyscrapers is very potent. And as he looks at it as a foreigner, he can't help but be impressed, but also perhaps can't help but think that this will not be enough. He goes on to say in the stanza, who can live for long in an euphoric dream? As though the place he is in is a euphoric dream. He has an awareness of himself being transplanted from the world he knows, which is now about to suffer. You know, the British didn't know on the very first day of the war, they're walking around carrying their gas masks because they don't know that at any minute the Luftwaffe might not come over the horizon and bomb them all to oblivion. And here Auden is in this foreign capital that seems so confident, at least architecturally, although as he suggests, the people he's with have on the individual level, a greater wisdom than that. And they are oppressed also, even though it's going to take a long time before the war touches them directly. But he's living in an euphoric dream. And we can't live in that state, he says, because out of the mirror they stare, imperialism's face and the international wrong, these political absolutes of power that the dream can't contain. But notice the way he puts it, they stare at us out of the mirror. And this gets to the quality of the poem that I was talking about before, which makes it, I think, stronger and more profound than Auden's critique of his own work allows for, that it is in the mirror that I see the ill that is affecting the world as a whole. That's where it comes home to me. I, David Anderson, am not responsible for imperialism and for the international wrong, and yet in a way I am responsible for these things, for this worship of power that has brought the world to this point, because in my own quiet, modest, middle-class professor's way, I worship power, or at least I'm daily tempted to, and redressing that is going to have to start with me. It's now that, as I say, he takes us on a little survey of the people he's around, these New Yorkers, some of whom are sharing the dive bar with him, who are feeling the weight of this day, even as their skyscrapers seem to confidently say, America, power, strength. The people he's among have a sense of dread, because it's they who will suffer concretely. The abstraction that the skyscrapers proclaim will be okay. It can't be blown up with a bomb, but they can be. And so he says, faces along the bar cling to their average day. So September 1st, 1939, especially in the new world of America, is just another day on the face of it. And so these people are trying to make out as though it's just another day, and yet they know something is wrong, even as they want to believe the lights must never go out, the music must always play. We want, of course, to be distracted from our reality, especially in a time like this. And everything in the world, he suggests, seems to be helping us to do that. All the conventions conspire to make this fort, Fortress America, assume the furniture of home, to make it as though nothing much is different. And so it's this kind of lie of the ordinary that we can notice once in a while, the thing that existentialists like Kierkegaard want to shake us out of to help us realize, no, 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 don't be distracted by the everyday, from noticing, not just in times of great international crisis, but all the time, the peril we're in. And so normal life is trying to tell us that it is still reigning, that it is still supreme, that nothing much has changed. It wants us to believe that, or we want for it to convince us of that. He says, lest we should see where we are, lost in a haunted wood, children afraid of the night, who have never been happy or good. So the terrible truth that everyday life sometimes is able to keep from us is that we are our own problem, which is not to say that Auden is saying that the Third Reich is not a heck of a problem, a terrible problem. It's not to say that there's an equivalence between the leaders of the Third Reich and the leaders of the average New Yorker in 1939. He's not making that equivalence, but he is saying that this dire situation is reminding us not just that Germany is in the control of evil men, but that we ourselves don't live in a way that would, in our own small, individual, particular case, go some way towards redressing the problems facing humanity. And so we have that kind of Dantean, on the one hand, or fairy tale-esque on the other, sense of ourselves as being children, in other words, not adequate to cope with this crisis, afraid of the night, lost in the wood, and never having been happy or good. You might not think that that fully fits your own situation, and fair enough, maybe it doesn't. But Auden is trying to awaken the reader to the fact that a day like this one should remind us of our own moral involvement in the problems of the world. He goes on, he goes deeper into this. What is our problem? Well, the following stanza sheds some light on that. He says, and he's talking here of the sort of dictator spirit, you know, that elderly rubbish he talked about earlier. He used the word rubbish. Now he uses the word trash. The windiest militant trash, important persons capitalized shout, is not so crude as our wish. So, you know, we can sit with a newspaper perched on the edge of this bar and read these terrible speeches that the Hitlers and the Stalins and the Mussolinis of the world are spouting off, shouting out. You know, think of those sickening images of Hitler shouting into his microphone. It's militant trash, but it's not as crude as things that are going on in all of us. And again, the point is not to suggest that he's relieving the dictators of moral responsibility so much as to suggest that they represent a kind of amplification, a horrible, unchecked amplification of things that are already going on in our own hearts. It is not so crude as our wish. And then he embroiders this with a little passage that would be obscure to most of us, unless you happen to know something about the history of dance in the 20th century. But he mentions two people, Nijinsky and Diaghilev, who come from that world. I am no expert here, to put it mildly. But he's talking about the great world-famous male ballet dancer Vaclav Nijinsky and the great dance impresario, the great impresario of Russian ballet at the turn of the 20th century, Sergei Diaghilev. And so he says, explaining the dark wishes in our heart, he says, what Mad Nijinsky wrote about Diaghilev is true of the normal heart. And so Nijinsky was this brilliant dancer, perhaps the most famous male dancer in the world in his lifetime, who eventually went mad for the last half of his life. If that word isn't too cruel, but he spent the last half of his life under various forms of psychological treatment. And he wrote about Diaghilev, who I believe was both his impresario at the height of his career or towards the end of his career, and also his lover. He later wrote of Diaghilev that Diaghilev did not want universal love, as Auden calls it. In other words, love shared among all people, love that goes to all people. He rather wanted all love for himself. And so Auden takes this statement and he says, it's true of all of us. It's true of all of us. It's the error bred in the bone. This is, if you like, original sin for Auden. And here he's not too far off from St. Augustine's understanding of original sin. But we all have this broken understanding of love, desire for love. As much as we might talk about peace on earth and about everyone loving everybody, not very many of us do it or seem to be capable of it. And what we all rather want is all love for ourselves. So this takes us back perhaps to, as he said, what happened at Linz and what huge imago made a psychopathic god, that we all have in our heart this urge to be worshipped, to be loved. And he says we can't have it, that we all crave, that we all have this error bred in the bone of each woman and each man, I'm quoting now, craves what it cannot have, not universal love, but to be loved alone. This is true of the normal heart. It's not just the great criminals of history who want this, but all of us on our own level, in our own way, at least fight this urge to be different and unique from all others, to be jealous of the loves that others give to others, and to want it all directed at ourselves, to want to suck in everything to us like emotional black holes. He now goes back to the moment. You'll notice that throughout the poem, he keeps returning to this moment, to this day in his own immediate situation. And he knows in the 1930s, just as much as today, that New York is very much defined by commuters. And he says, so from the conservative dark into the ethical life, the dense commuters come. So this is an image of people coming up out of subway platforms onto the street level. That's what you do in New York. You go down into the subway, you ride the train somewhere, and then you come up to the surface level. And so what he means by the conservative dark, he's not talking about political conservatism. He's talking about this sort of space of private interiority that we emerge from into what he calls, with kind of deliberate pomposity, the ethical life, the life of the sun. There's a hint here of Plato's cave, of emergence out of the realm of false shadows into the pure realm of the good, where the sun is shining. And so the commuters come out of this space. And what he imagines going on in their minds is of a piece with what he had called that error bred in the bone of wanting to be loved alone. He says they come into the sunshine and they're repeating their morning vow, trying to be better. So that might be, as he says, I will be true to the wife. And notice the phrase, the wife, instead of my wife. People speak that way. We say the wife, men do sometimes. And Auden catches that phrase and repeats it. And it's suggesting, I think, a kind of objectification or distancing from the wife as this thing you have to be true to. But there's not much sense of blood moving back and forth within the relationship. So I will be true to the wife. I'll concentrate more on my work, another person might be thinking of. And so that's what the commuters are thinking. And then he refers to what he calls the helpless governors, those who rule the world and play what he calls the compulsory game. But the sense here is that all of us, the commuters on the street and the governors in their skyscrapers, are all caught up in something that is stronger than these morning vows of being better, that we're all of us making every day the equivalent of New Year's resolutions, which we mostly break. We're all caught up in this. And now we come to the last couple of stanzas about which Auden felt such antipathy, but I think they are wonderful, even if I can at the same time appreciate his own criticism of them. They sound maybe a little too assertive of the poet's own special distance from these things, even though I think the poem makes clear that the poet never is fooled by the idea that he's different, that he's better. But he says, "All I have is a voice." And remember, this is a man who doesn't think he's fit to fix his bayonet and go over the top and fight. All he has is his voice. "To undo the folded lie, the romantic lie in the brain." I love that phrase, "the folded lie," because when he mentions the brain, we have the image of the brain as being these folds of gray matter, and the lie sort of folded up and slipped between those folds without being noticed. The romantic lie in the brain of the sensual man in the street. Well, what is that? Well, we just saw the sensual man in the street saying, you know, "I'm going to be better. I'm going to do better. It's going to be okay. I can change things. I can be a better husband. I can be a better employee. I've got this." It's the romantic lie in the brain. And then he contrasts that with a different kind of lie, what he calls the lie of authority, whose buildings grope the sky, taking us back to those skyscrapers. And that word "grope" is a telling one, as though the skyscrapers, which he said had reared up to proclaim the strength of collective man, are offering a kind of assault on the sky. We remember the Tower of Babel raised by Nimrod as a sort of challenge to the gods, and that God himself flips the script on those builders of Babel. And so the idea that those buildings are groping the sky, that word, that verb, connotes something sordid and inappropriate that those skyscrapers are doing. But they reflect not the romantic lie, as Auden calls it, but the lie of authority. The lie of authority, which seems to say that the strength of collective man is sufficient to redress these problems. You might say we have on the one hand the lie of sort of commonplace morality, and on the other, the lie of politics, that these problems, which Auden had said are bred in the bone, that all of us carry in our bone marrow, can be fixed by electing the right government or by dropping by the self-help section of a bookstore. Not that they had such sections in 1939. In order to combat these two lies, he makes a couple of sweeping statements, absolutely sweeping statements, that I really like. He says, "There is no such thing as the state, and no one exists alone." Now, what's he saying there? Well, he's just established the romantic lie in the brain of every man, of that commuter. And he's established the lie of authority, and now he's contradicting each in turn. There is no such thing as the state. Auden does not literally believe that there are no states, that there is no such thing as the United States of America, or the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, or the Third Reich of the German nation. He knows those things exist, but they are abstractions. They are not independently freestanding things that are simply containers of people, that they are ideas we hold about reality, but that we have to hold them lightly. And I think the point is that we can't look to them as we're combating this psychopathic god who's dominating Central Europe. We can't imagine that the solution lies simply in this abstraction called the state. But then on the other hand, he says, no one exists alone. And no one exists alone is a way of redressing that romantic lie, which believes that me in my own little world, facing my own little problems, shutting out the wider world is reality. No, we are connected to each other. And so we have a sort of ethic here that seems to be comparable to that of Dostoevsky, who in his later novels so often stressed our mutual responsibility for one another, that we have responsibility for things even when they seem far away from us, not to necessarily solve problems, but to act in a way, to act in love, not the love of Diaghilev that wants to be loved alone, but the way of genuine love that might, in our own small corner, correct the tendencies that, when they become more and more widespread, threaten us all. He says, hunger allows no choice to the citizen or the police. You know, all of us are animals, and all of us are driven by need, and we can only expect so much of human beings, whether the citizen or the policeman in uniform. And so his conclusion at the end of this penultimate stanza is, we must love one another or die. Now, this in particular is the line, we must love one another or die, that Auden objected to. I love it. Later he changed it to, we must love one another and die. Because I believe there was the idea for him that he was offering what felt like a sort of tinny, pat answer to this problem, a cheap answer, a kind of Haight-Ashbury 1960s answer of put a daisy in the assault rifle barrel and all the problems go away. I don't think that line necessarily needs to be read so cheaply, but he said we must love one another and die, as though to undo the idea that he's offering a sort of flimsy feel-good answer. I think what he's doing is in the spirit of King Lear, which I discussed a couple of episodes ago, where genuine love of the other, sacrificial love of the other, is on the one hand presented as this terribly, terribly costly thing, this thing that might cost you everything, but on the other hand, as an absolute moral imperative before which all of us have to bow, whatever the cost, that the choice that Lear seems to force on us is that we are either with Edmund and Regan and the Duke of Cornwall, or we are standing with Cordelia, ready to suffer the consequences of actually loving. So Auden seemed to critique that line for a kind of immaturity, but I don't think we need to see it that way. Perhaps that's my immaturity. Anyhow, in the final stanza, he says that we're defenseless under the night, giving again, you know, people in the 1930s knew that aircraft were becoming sophisticated enough and bombs were becoming sophisticated enough that the bombing of civilian centers was a real likelihood in another world war. And so when he says that we're defenseless under the night, it gives that idea of people wondering if death is going to be falling from the sky. And of course, in London, and then in many other of the great cities of Germany eventually, and then, of course, most famously at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, people did discover they're living defenseless under the night, and that the bombs would rain down and couldn't really be stopped. And so we're defenseless under the night, our world in stupor lies. It's this sense of confusion and, you know, almost a sort of generosity on Auden's part, I think, directed partly at himself and also at all those others whom he's watching and overhearing. This idea that the world is just punch drunk right now and hardly knows what's coming and can't face it. So the world in stupor lies, but he says, dotted everywhere. And everywhere has to not only include, by necessity, America and Britain and France, the good guys, but also even in places as dark as Germany in 1939, there are ironic points of light. Now, ironic is an interesting word. suggesting contrast with the darkness, suggesting a kind of worldly wisdom. But these are points of light, he says, that flash out wherever the just, with a capital J, exchange their messages. They are ironic because they're points of contradiction to the gathering light, but they are winking out. And so Auden ends the poem with a kind of prayer, saying, may I be one of those who flashes that ironic point of light. May I, composed like them of Eros and of dust. So I'm one of these strange creatures, a human being, on the one hand made of the clay of the physical world, on the other hand with this spark of Eros, this desire for something more. May I, who am beleaguered by the same negation and despair, show an affirming flame. So there is an ending here that is a kind of prayer for an integrity that the poet wants. And, you know, the poor man may have had trouble ending a poem like this. The prayer he makes is such a simple one. All he asks is that he show the affirming flame, the affirmation of love, love being at its heart, a movement of affirmation for the other, an affirmation of what is good. An affirmation, I suppose, of hope, although he doesn't want to go so far as to articulate hope. If you'd told people in 1939 that the war would last 6 years and that it would leave something like 50 million dead, but that the Western world, even though it had to collude with the Soviet Union, would be victorious and would survive, albeit battered, and that the United States would be the dominant world power after that point, a lot of people probably would have taken that deal and been relieved that it wasn't even worse. Because no one in 1939 knew how bad it could be, and that those 50 million dead are certainly bad enough. And so he's caught in this moment of fear and uncertainty, allowing us to see him as trying to sum up the courage to stand morally in a right posture. He doesn't have the capacity to win the war on his own any more than any other man on the street did, but he's asking for the courage and the integrity to, in his own way, contradict the lies and not give in to the darkness. I'll come now back to the poem that I began the episode with, just because I think it provides an interesting comment on Auden and on some of his lifelong preoccupations, and because it seems to articulate a little bit of the kind of spirit he was driving at in September 1st, 1939. This is a simple poem, fairly well known among readers of 20th century poetry, called The More Loving One. It's written almost 20 years after September 1st, 1939. So it's a poem of the 50s when Auden is in the sort of late phase of his career. And it's an unexpected take on the old subject of unrequited love. It's a poem that's admired because of its sort of insouciance, and at the same time that in its insouciance, in its sort of cheekiness, it manages to say something deep for all its sort of sing-song simplicity and kind of winking aspect. For one thing, it says something about how much tone matters to poetry. Like, I can read the same poem in two or three different ways and give it a completely different feeling. This poem can be made to sound sort of cheap and throwaway and self-indulgent, although hopefully I didn't read it that way, because I think it's tempting us to reduce it to that level, but that we are not supposed to. The More Loving One is dominated by the central metaphor of stars. And that's fitting because it's a poem about unrequited love, and the star is one of the great perennial images of unrequited love. The star is beautiful, but it is remote and inaccessible, and we can't reach it. We can only admire it. And so the beloved in the sonnet tradition of European love poetry is often equated with the star, that she is too high and too beautiful and too perfect and too far away, and all I can do is eat my heart out. I could never hope to have her. And so that image is quite appropriate, but Auden takes it with a sort of bizarre seriousness in this poem, as though the star itself is really what we're talking about. One thing that he's doing here, even as he's alluding to that love tradition, he's also alluding more directly, I suppose, to our modern kind of existential dilemma. We learned long ago that the star is a ball of flaming gas burning hundreds of light years away. And that contradicted the old cosmology of the ancient and medieval world, which imagined the star as being very, very, very far away, but also moved by what was generally called an intelligence, whether that was a god or a kind of angelic spirit, that gave the star its motive force. That was the reason, I suppose, as to why it burned, that it wasn't just the fusion reaction of hydrogen atoms smashing into each other because of overwhelming gravity and turning into helium and causing this billions of years long nuclear reaction, but rather the stars are personal. And here Auden is speaking as a modern who knows very well that no, they are not personal, even though the real Auden, I think, would have wanted to believe more than that. And of course, the star can also be a metaphor for God himself. Is it God who is distant and indifferent, a mere kind of deistic force that sets things going, but that has no real depth of care for his creatures? Auden struggled with doubts over his own religion throughout his life, even though he always had this deep, deep ethical commitment to it. But all of this is at stake in the poem. And so the poem turns into, in its cheeky way, not just a sort of temporary solution to the problem of unrequited love. X loves Y, but Y does not love X, so what is X to do? But a discussion of the nature of love as such. And since love was as close as Auden came to offering a solution in 1939, I thought that this little piece would be a good one to put into conversation with that poem. And so he looks up at the stars and he knows that as a good inhabitant of the modern world, that since they are just balls of gas burning, for all they care, I can go to hell. And one might think that of the beloved, that for all she cares, I can go to hell. Or one might think that of God. He says, on earth, indifference is the least we have to dread from man or beast. And that might be true enough in a sense that there are worse things that can happen to us than indifference in this carnivorous world filled with dictators. But is it really the worst? Is indifference really such a light matter? He asks an interesting question in the second stanza. How should we like it really if we knew that all of those billions of stars were burning with an overwhelming passion for us? Would that not be a terrible weight to bear? And so the heart of the poem comes in the following two lines, which Auden moves on from, but I don't think he wants us to move on from. And so he says, if equal affection cannot be, let the more loving one be me. It's superficially much more gratifying if one can't have perfect, idealized, balanced, mutual love. It's certainly more gratifying to be loved than to love. And that's what King Lear wants in the play. He wants to be loved. He wants those daughters to offer their worshipful pains, hymns to his greatness, and to extol his greatness, and to offer these overwhelming professions of undying love for him. And he doesn't want to have much skin in the game. He'll be happy enough to say, I love you too, I suppose, but he doesn't want to have to mean it. He doesn't want it to be tested. And that's that error bred in the bone, where we so often become King Lear and so rarely become Cordelia. But Auden says that it's better to be Cordelia. Let the more loving one be me. In the last two stanzas of this little poem, he goes on to say, in this, again, sort of insouciant way, I can't say that I think about the stars that much. I love the stars when I look up at them out in the night sky. But I can't say I'm burdened down with missing them too much or any one of them too much during the day when the stars cannot be seen. So who am I to say that I'm so filled with love for them? But let the more loving one be me, but it doesn't seem to be that weighty a matter. And then we have an interesting turn in the final stanza as he imagines a night sky bereft of stars where there were no stars. And he says, I could get used to that. I could look up at the empty sky and just feel that absolute blackness and get used to it. Although he concedes in the last line in a concession that says a great deal for all of its casualness. This might take me a little time. That attachment to the stars and whatever they signify, given one's reading of the poem, is a strong and heavy thing. And so, getting used to the idea of there being no stars, of there being nothing to love up there, wouldn't be the easiest adjustment. If equal affection cannot be, let the more loving one be me. That is, a statement that volunteers for suffering in a way. He is accepting the potential pain, saying that it would be better to be the one with the open heart who loves than to be the one with the closed heart who doesn't feel. And so in this little ditty that never really attempts to seriously explore the great commitment made in those two lines which I've singled out, he nevertheless teases that idea, which I think is so central to September 1st, 1939, that to show that affirming flame is to be willing to love, to be willing to take on the sort of personal burden of that love and everything that it entails, rather than to slink along in that romantic lie or that lie of authority, thinking that it's for other people to solve the problems, thinking that humanity in general, the lie of collective man, can carry the burden of our moral work, or that I can just be left to myself in my own little quiet corner to fix my own life and to shut out everyone else. When he says, let the more loving one be me, he is accepting, voluntarily accepting, not just the burden of his own existence, but the burden of mine too, to a certain extent, the burden of everyone else's. And he's doing so knowing that he can't himself carry that burden sufficiently to solve all of our problems, but that none of our problems will be touched unless all of us are willing to do that. So we come to the end of this little discussion of Auden without any hard, clear answers. But I hope we've gone some way to answering his own doubts about the poem, if not fully, then at least to a degree. And I hope you've enjoyed experiencing this little bit of Auden. So thank you very much for listening. On behalf of Eric Williams, this is David Anderson, and we look forward to being with you again soon.